law has been ignored. Remember Jane from earlier in Rule Number 3. She dropped out of college with the vague idea that some sort of online business would support a lifestyle of adventure. If she had met Derek Sivers, she would have delayed this move until she had real evidence that she could make money online. In this case, the law would have served its purpose well, as a simple experiment would have likely revealed that passive income websites are more myth than reality, and thus prevented her rash abandonment of her education. This doesn't mean that Jane would have had to resign herself to a life of boring work. On the contrary, the law could have provided her structure to keep exploring variations on her adventurous life vision until she could find one to pursue that would actually yield results. Summary of Rule Number 3. Rules Number 1 and Number 2 laid the foundation for my new thinking on how people end up loving what they do. Rule Number 1 dismissed the passion hypothesis, which says that you first have to figure out your true calling and then find a job to match. Rule Number 2 replaced this idea with career capital theory, which argues that the traits that define great work are rare and valuable, and that if you want these in your working life, you must first build up rare and valuable skills to offer in return. I call these skills career capital, and in Rule Number 2, I dived into the details of how to acquire it. The obvious next question is how to invest this capital once you have it. Rule Number 3 explored one answer to this question by arguing that gaining control over what you do and how you do it is incredibly important. This trait shows up so often in the lives of people who love what they do that I've taken to calling it the dream job elixir. Investing your capital in control, however, turns out to be tricky. There are two traps that commonly snare people in their pursuit of this trait. The first control trap notes that it's dangerous to try to gain more control without enough capital to back it up. The second control trap notes that once you have the capital to back up a bid for more control, you're still not out of the woods. This capital makes you valuable enough to your employer that they will likely now fight to keep you on a more traditional path. They realize that gaining more control is good for you, but not for their bottom line. The control traps put you in a difficult situation. Let's say you have an idea for pursuing more control in your career and you're encountering resistance. How can you tell if this resistance is useful? For example, it's helping you avoid the first control trap. Or something to ignore. For example, it's the result of the second control trap. To help navigate this control conundrum, I turn to Derek Sivers. Derek is a successful entrepreneur who has lived a life dedicated to control. I asked him his advice for sifting through potential control-boosting pursuits, and he responded with a simple rule. Do what people are willing to pay for. This isn't about making money. Derek, for example, is more or less indifferent to money, having given away to charity the millions he made from selling his first company. Instead, it's about using money as a neutral indicator of value, a way of determining whether or not you have enough career capital to succeed with a pursuit. I called this the law of financial viability and concluded that it's a critical tool for navigating your own acquisition of control. This holds whether you are pondering an entrepreneurial venture or a new role within an established company. Unless people are willing to pay you, it's not an idea you're ready to go after. Rule Number 4. Think small, act big. Or the importance of mission. Chapter 12. The Meaningful Life of Pardee Sabeti. In which I argue that a unifying mission to your working life can be a source of great satisfaction. The Happy Professor. Harvard's state-of-the-art Northwest Science Building is found at 52 Oxford Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a 10-minute walk from the tourists packing the university's famed Central Yard. It's part of a complex of hulking brick and glass laboratories that form the new heart of Harvard's fabled research engine. Inside, the Northwest looks like a Hollywood vision of a science lab. The hallways defining the perimeter of each floor are polished concrete and lit dimly in the style of television crime procedurals. Inside the hallways in the center of the building are the wet labs, with graduate students manipulating pipettes visible through windowed steel doors. On the other side of the hallway are the professors' offices, defined by floor-to-ceiling glass partitions. It was one of these offices in particular that drew me to the Northwest on a sunny June afternoon, the office of Pardee Sabeti, a 35-year-old professor of evolutionary biology who had mastered one of the more elusive but powerful strategies in the quest for work you love. One of the first things you'll notice if you spend time around Pardee is that she enjoys her life. Biology, like any high-stakes academic field, is demanding. Because of this, it has a reputation for turning young professors into curmudgeons who adopt a masochistic brand of workaholism, in which relaxation becomes a sign of failure and the accomplishments of peers become tragedies. This can be a bleak existence. Pardee, for her part, has avoided this fate. Not 5 minutes into my visit, for example, a young grad student, one of 10 people Pardee employs in her eponymous Sabeti lab, pokes his head into the office. "We're heading down to volleyball practice," he says, referencing the lab's team, which evidently takes itself seriously. She promises to join them as soon as our interview ends. Volleyball is not Pardee's only hobby. In a corner of her office, she keeps an acoustic guitar that serves as more than decoration. Pardee plays in a band called Thousand Days, which is well known in Boston music circles. In 2008, PBS featured the band in a Nova special called Researchers Who Rock. Pardee's energy for these activities is a side effect of her enthusiasm for her work. The bulk of her research focuses on Africa, with studies ongoing in Senegal, Sierra Leone, and most of all, Nigeria. To Pardee, this work is about more than just the accumulation of publications and grant money. At one point in our conversation, for example, she pulls out her laptop. "You have to see this video of me and my girls," she says, loading up a YouTube clip of Pardee, guitar in hand, leading a group of 4 African women in a song. The video was shot outdoors in Nigeria. Palm trees provided the backdrop. The women, I learn, work in a clinic supported by the Sabeti lab. "These women deal with people who die in devastating ways every day," she says to no one in particular while the video plays. On screen, everyone is smiling while Pardee leads them with mixed success through the verses. "I love going there," she adds. "Nigeria is my African home." It's clear that Pardee has avoided the grinding cynicism that traps so many young academics and has instead built an engaging life. "It's not always easy," she once said in an interview, "but I truly love what I do." But how did she pull off this feat? As I spent time with Pardee, I recognized that her happiness comes from the fact that she built her career on a clear and compelling mission, something that not only gives meaning to her work, but provides the energy needed to embrace life beyond the lab. In the overachieving style typical of Harvard, Pardee's mission is by no means subtle. Her goal, put simply, is to rid the world of its most ancient and deadly diseases. Pardee's mission. As a graduate student, Pardee stumbled into the emerging field of computational genetics, the use of computers to help understand DNA sequences. She developed an algorithm that sifts through databases of human genetic information, looking for traces of an elusive target, ongoing human evolution. To the general public, the idea that humans are still evolving can be surprising, but among evolutionary biologists, it's taken for granted. One of the classic examples of recent human evolution is lactose tolerance, the ability to digest milk into adulthood, a trait that didn't start spreading through the human population until we domesticated milk-producing animals. Pardee's algorithm uses statistical techniques to hunt down patterns of gene migration that match what you would expect from selective pressure. For example, a mutation that popped up recently in human development but has since spread quickly among a population. The algorithm, in other words, searches blindly, turning up candidate genes that look like they're the result of natural selection, but leaving it up to the researcher to figure out why natural selection deemed the gene useful. Pardy uses the algorithm to search for recently evolved genes that provide disease resistance. Her logic is that if she can find these genes and understand how they work, biomedical researchers might be able to mimic their benefit in a treatment. It makes sense, of course, that disease resistance genes would be among the candidates turned up by Pardy's algorithm, as they provide a classic example of natural selection in action. If a deadly virus has been killing off humans in a population for a long time, biologists would say that this population is under selective pressure. If a lucky few members of the group then happen to evolve a resistance to the disease, this pressure ensures that the new gene will spread quickly. People with the new gene die less frequently than those without it. This rapid spread of a new gene is exactly the type of signature Pardy's algorithm has been tuned to detect. Pardy's first big discovery was a gene that provides resistance to Lassa fever, one of the oldest and most deadly diseases of the African continent, responsible for tens of thousands of deaths each year. People don't just die with this disease, she emphasized. They die extreme deaths. She has since added malaria and the bubonic plague to the list of ancient scourges that she's tackling with her computational strategy. Pardy's career is driven by a clear mission, to use new technology to fight old diseases. This research is clearly important, an observation emphasized by the fact that she's received 7-figure grants for her work from both the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the NIH. Later in this audiobook, we'll dive into the details of how she found this focus, but what's important to note now is that her mission provides her a sense of purpose and energy, traits that have helped her avoid becoming a cynical academic, and instead embrace her work with enthusiasm. Her mission is the foundation on which she builds love for what she does, and therefore, it's a career strategy we need to better understand. The power of mission. To have a mission is to have a unifying focus for your career. It's more general than a specific job and can span multiple positions. It provides an answer to the question, what should I do with my life? Missions are powerful because they focus your energy toward a useful goal, and this, in turn, maximizes your impact on your world, a crucial factor in loving what you do. People who feel like their careers truly matter are more satisfied with their working lives, and they're also more resistant to the strain of hard work. Staying up late to save your corporate litigation client a few extra million dollars can be draining, but staying up late to help cure an ancient disease can leave you more energized than when you started, perhaps even providing the extra enthusiasm needed to start a lab volleyball team or tour with a rock band. I was drawn to Pardy Sabeti because her career is driven by a mission, and she's reaped happiness in return. After meeting her, I went searching for other people who leveraged this trait to create work they love. This search led me to a young archaeologist whose mission to popularize his field led to his own television series on the Discovery Channel, and to a bored programmer who systematically studied marketing to devise a mission that injected excitement back into his working life. In all three cases, I tried to decode exactly how these individuals found and then successfully deployed their missions. In short, I wanted an answer to an important question. How do you make mission a reality in your working life? The answers I found are complicated. To better understand this complexity, let's put the topic back into the broader context of the book. In the preceding rules, I have argued that follow your passion is bad advice, as most people aren't born with pre-existing passions waiting to be discovered. If your goal is to love what you do, you must first build up career capital by mastering rare and valuable skills, and then cash in this capital for the traits that define great work. As I'll explain, mission is one of these desirable traits, and like any such desirable trait, it too requires that you first build career capital, A mission launched without this expertise is likely doomed to sputter and die. But capital alone is not enough to make a mission a reality. Plenty of people are good at what they do, but haven't reoriented their career in a compelling direction. Accordingly, I will go on to explore a pair of advanced tactics that also play an important role in making the leap from a good idea for a mission to actually making that mission a reality. In the chapters ahead, you'll learn the value of systematically experimenting with different proto-missions to seek out a direction worth pursuing. You'll also learn the necessity of deploying a marketing mindset in the search for your focus. In other words, missions are a powerful trait to introduce into your working life, but they're also fickle, requiring careful coaxing to make them a reality. This subtlety probably explains why so many people lack an organizing focus to their careers, even though such focus is widely admired. Missions are hard. By this point in my quest, however, I had become comfortable with hard, and I hope that if you've made it this far in the audiobook, you have gained this comfort as well. Hardness scares off the daydreamers and the timid, leaving more opportunity for those like us who are willing to take the time to carefully work out the best path forward and then confidently take action. Chapter 13. Missions Require Capital, in which I argue that a mission chosen before you have relevant career capital is not likely to be sustainable. Mission Failure. When Sarah wrote me, she was stuck. She had recently quit her job as a newspaper editor to attend graduate school to study cognitive science. Sarah had considered grad school right out of college, but at the time, she worried that she didn't have the right skills. With age, however, came more confidence, and after she signed up for and then aced an artificial intelligence course that would have scared a younger version of myself, Sarah decided to take the plunge and become a full-time doctoral candidate. Then the trouble started. Not long into her new student career, Sarah became paralyzed by her work's lack of an organizing mission. "I feel I have too many interests," she told me. "I can't decide if I want to do theoretical work or something more applied, or which would be more useful. Even more threatening, I believe all the other researchers to be geniuses. What would you do if you were in my shoes?" Sarah's story reminded me of Jane, whom I introduced in Rule Number 3. As you might recall, Jane dropped out of college to start a nonprofit to develop my vision of health, human potential, and a life well lived. This mission, unfortunately, ran into a harsh financial reality when Jane failed to raise money to support her vague vision. When I met her, she was soliciting advice about finding a normal job, a task that was proving difficult because she lacked a degree. Both Sarah and Jane recognized the power of mission, but struggled to deploy the trait in their own working lives. Sarah desperately wanted a Party Sabetti style of life-transforming research focus, yet her failure to immediately identify such a focus led her to rethink graduate school. Jane, on the other hand, slapped together something vague, a nonprofit that would develop my vision of a life well lived, and then hoped the details would work themselves out once she got started. Jane fared no better than Sarah. The details, it turned out, did not work themselves out, leaving Jane penniless and still without a college degree. I tell these stories because they emphasize an important point. Missions are tricky. As Sarah and Jane learned, just because you really want to organize your work around a mission doesn't mean that you can easily make it happen. After my visit to Harvard, I realized that if I was going to deploy this trait in my own career, I needed to better understand this trickiness. That is, I needed to figure out what Party did differently than Jane and Sarah. The answer I eventually found came from an unexpected place, the attempts to explain a puzzling phenomenon. The baffling popularity of randomized linear network coding. As I write this chapter, I'm attending a computer science conference in San Jose, California. Earlier today, something interesting happened. I attended a session in which four different professors from four different universities presented their latest research. Surprisingly, all four presentations tackled the same narrow problem, information dissemination in networks, using the same narrow technique, randomized linear network coding. It was as if my research community woke up one morning and collectively and spontaneously decided to tackle the same esoteric problem. This example of joint discovery surprised me, but it would not have surprised the science writer Stephen Johnson. In his engaging 2010 book, Where Good Ideas Come From, Johnson explains that such multiples are frequent in the history of science. Consider the discovery of sunspots in 1611. As Johnson notes, four scientists from four different countries all identified the phenomenon during that same year. The first electrical battery, invented twice in the mid-18th century. Oxygen, isolated independently in 1772 and 1774. In one study cited by Johnson, researchers from Columbia University found just shy of 150 different examples of prominent scientific breakthroughs made by multiple researchers at near the same time. These examples of simultaneous discovery, though interesting, might seem tangential to our interest in career mission. I ask, however, that you stick with me, as the explanation for this phenomenon is the first link in a chain of logic that helped me decode what Party did differently than Sarah and Jane. Big ideas, Johnson explained, are almost always discovered in the adjacent possible, a term borrowed from the complex system biologist Stuart Kaufman, who used it to describe the spontaneous formation of complex chemical structures from simpler structures. Given a soup of chemical components, sloshing and mixing together, noted Kaufman, lots of new chemicals will form. Not every new chemical, however, is equally likely. The new chemicals you'll find are those that can be made by combining the structures already in the soup. That is, the new chemicals are in the space of the adjacent possible defined by the current structures. When Johnson adopted the term, he shifted it from complex chemicals to cultural and scientific innovations. We take the ideas we've inherited or that we've stumbled across, and we jigger them together into some new shape, he explained. The next big ideas in any field are found right beyond the current cutting edge, in the adjacent space that contains the possible new combinations of existing ideas. The reason important discoveries often happen multiple times, therefore, is that they only become possible once they enter the adjacent possible, at which point anyone surveying this space, that is, those who are the current cutting edge, will notice the same innovations waiting to happen. The isolation of oxygen as a component of air, to name one of Johnson's examples of a multiple discovery, wasn't possible until two things happened. First, scientists began to think about air as a substance containing elements, not just a void. And second, sensitive scales, a key tool in the needed experiments, became available. Once these two developments occurred, the isolation of oxygen became a big fat target in the newly defined adjacent possible, visible to anyone who happened to be looking in that direction. Two scientists, Carl Wilhelm Scheele and Joseph Priestley, were looking in this direction, and therefore both went on to conduct the necessary experiments independently, but at nearly the same time. The adjacent possible also explains my earlier example of four researchers tackling the same obscure problem with the same obscure technique at the conference I attended. The specific technique applied in this case, a technique called randomized linear network coding, came to the attention of the computer scientists I work with only over the last 2 years as researchers who study a related topic began to apply it successfully to thorny problems. The scientists who ended up presenting papers on this technique at my conference had all noticed its potential around the same time. Put in Johnson's terms, this technique redefined the cutting edge in my corner of the academic world, and therefore it also redefined the adjacent possible, and in this new configuration, the information dissemination problem, like the discovery of oxygen many centuries earlier, suddenly loomed as a big target waiting to be tackled. We like to think of innovation as striking us in a stunning eureka moment, where you all at once change the way people see the world, leaping far ahead of our current understanding. I'm arguing that in reality, innovation is more systematic. We grind away to expand the cutting edge, opening up new problems in the adjacent possible to tackle and therefore expand the cutting edge some more, opening up more new problems, and so on. The truth, Johnson explains, is that technological and scientific advances rarely break out of the adjacent possible. As I mentioned, understanding the adjacent possible and its role in innovation is the first link in a chain of argument that explains how to identify a good career mission. In the next section, I'll forge the second link, which connects the world of scientific breakthroughs to the world of work. The capital-driven mission. Scientific breakthroughs, as we just learned, require that you first get to the cutting edge of your field. Only then can you see the adjacent possible beyond, the space where innovative ideas are almost always discovered. Here's the leap I made as I pondered Pardi Sabeti around the same time I was pondering Johnson's theory of innovation. A good career mission is similar to a scientific breakthrough. It's an innovation waiting to be discovered in the adjacent possible of your field. If you want to identify a mission for your working life, therefore, you must first get to the cutting edge, the only place where these missions become visible. This insight explains Sarah's struggles. She was trying to find a mission before she got to the cutting edge. She was still in her first 2 years as a graduate student when she began to panic about her lack of focus. From her vantage point as a new graduate student, she was much too far from the cutting edge to have any hope of surveying the adjacent possible, and if she can't see the adjacent possible, she's not likely to identify a compelling new direction for her work. According to Johnson's theory, Sarah would have been better served by first mastering a promising niche, a task that may take years, and only then turning her attention to seeking a mission. This distance from the adjacent possible also tripped up Jane. She wanted to start a transformative nonprofit that changed the way people live their lives. A successful nonprofit, however, needs a specific philosophy with strong evidence for its effectiveness. Jane didn't have such a philosophy. To find one, she would have needed a nice view of the adjacent possible in her corner of the nonprofit sector. And this would have required that she first get to the cutting edge of efforts to better people's lives, a process that, as with Sarah, requires patience and perhaps years of work. Jane was trying to identify a mission before she got to the cutting edge, and she predictably didn't come up with anything that could turn people's heads. In hindsight, these observations are obvious. If life-transforming missions could be found with just a little navel-gazing and an optimistic attitude, changing the world would be commonplace. But it's not commonplace. It's instead quite rare. This rareness, we now understand, is because these breakthroughs require that you first get to the cutting edge. And this is hard. The type of hardness that most of us try to avoid in our working lives. Those who have been paying attention will notice that this talk of getting to the cutting edge echoes the idea of career capital, which was introduced back in Rule Number 2. As you'll recall, career capital is my term for rare and valuable skills. It is, I argued, your main bargaining chip in creating work you love. Most people who love their work got where they are by first building up career capital and then cashing it in for the types of traits that define great work. Getting to the cutting edge of a field can be understood in these terms. This process builds up rare and valuable skills, and therefore builds up your store of career capital. Similarly, identifying a compelling mission once you get to the cutting edge can be seen as investing your career capital to acquire a desirable trait in your career. In other words, mission is yet another example of career capital theory in action. If you want a mission, you need to first acquire capital. If you skip this step, you might end up like Sarah and Jane, with lots of enthusiasm, but very little to show for it. Not surprisingly, when we return to the story of Pardee Sabetti, we find that her path to a mission provides a nice example of this career capital perspective translated into practice. Pardee's patience. "I think you do need passion to be happy," Pardee Sabetti told me. At first, this sounds like she's supporting the passion hypothesis that I debunked in rule number one. But then she elaborated, "It's just that we don't know what that passion is. If you ask someone, they'll tell you what they think they're passionate about, but they probably have it wrong." In other words, she believes that having passion for your work is vital, but she also believes that it's a fool's errand to try to figure out in advance what work will lead to this passion. When you hear Pardee's story, the origin of this philosophy becomes clear. "In high school, I was obsessed with math," she told me. Then she had a biology teacher whom she loved, which made her think that biology might be for her. When she arrived at MIT, she was forced to choose between math and bio. "It turns out that the MIT bio department has an unbelievable emphasis on teaching," she explained. "So I majored in bio." With a bio major came a new plan. She decided she was destined to become a doctor. "I perceived myself as someone who cared about people. I wanted to practice medicine." Pardee did very well at MIT, won a Rhodes Scholarship, and used it to go earn her PhD at Oxford. She focused on biological anthropology, a typically archaic Oxfordian name for a field most would simply call genetics. It was at Oxford that Pardee decided that Africa and infectious diseases were also a potentially interesting topic to study. If you're keeping count, this was the third field that at some point in her student career attracted her. The full list now contains math, medicine, and infectious disease. This is why she's wary of the strategy of trying to identify your one true calling in advance. In her experience, lots of different things can, at different times, seem compelling. Given her new interest in Africa, Pardee joined a research group using genetic analysis to help African Americans trace their genealogy back to regions of Africa. After a year or so, Pardee decided to switch labs, and she moved into another, suggested by a friend. This lab was tackling the genetics of malaria. After Oxford, Pardee returned to Harvard Medical School to earn her M.D. Amazingly, even as she was finishing up a Ph.D. in genetics, she wasn't ready yet to abandon her earlier premonition that she was somehow meant to be a doctor. The result was that she became a young med student, finishing a Ph.D. thesis during her spare time. "If you want to write a thing about having a quality, enjoyable life, don't ask me about my time at Harvard," she warned. Harvard was a tough time. Pardee finished her dissertation and became a postdoctoral fellow, continuing to juggle this work with the end of her MD program, taking the subway back and forth between Harvard and MIT, where she was now working at the Broad Institute with the famed geneticist Eric Lander. It was during this period that her ideas about using statistical analysis to find evidence of recent human evolution began to yield results, culminating in the 2002 publication of a major paper in Nature with the innocuous title, "Detecting Recent Positive Selection in the Human Genome from Haplotype Structure." According to Google Scholar, the work has been cited over 720 times since its publication. "People started treating me differently after that paper," Pardee says. "That's when the faculty offers started coming in." Though she finished her M.D. somewhere in this period, it was not until this point that her mission finally became clear. Becoming a clinical doctor didn't make sense. She was going to build a research career focused on her use of computational genetics to combat ancient diseases. Pardee took a professorship at Harvard, finally ready to commit to a single focus in her working life. What struck me about Pardee's story is how remarkably late it was in her training before she identified the mission that now defines her career. This lateness is best represented by her decision to still attend and finish medical school even though she was working on PhD research that was starting to attract notice. These are not the actions of someone who is certain of her destiny from day one. This certainty didn't come until later, around the time of her Nature publication, when Pardee had finally developed her computational genetics ideas to the point where their usefulness and novelty were obvious. To use my terminology, this long period of training, starting with her undergraduate biology classes and continuing through her PhD and then postdoctoral work at the Broad Institute, was when she was building up her stores of career capital. When she took a professorship at Harvard, she was finally ready to cash in this capital to obtain the mission-driven career she enjoys today. Rule number 4 is entitled, Think Small, Act Big. It's in this understanding of career capital and its role in mission that we get our explanation for this title. Advancing to the cutting edge in a field is an act of small thinking, requiring you to focus on a narrow collection of subjects for a potentially long time. Once you get to the cutting edge, however, and discover a mission in the adjacent possible, you must go after it with zeal, a big action. Pardee Sabetti thought small by focusing patiently for years on a narrow niche, the genetics of diseases in Africa. But then, acting big once she acquired enough capital to identify a mission, using computational genetics to help understand and fight ancient diseases. Sarah and Jane, by contrast, reversed this order. They started by thinking big, looking for a world-changing mission, but without capital they could only match this big thinking with small, ineffectual acts. The art of mission, we can conclude, asks us to suppress the most grandiose of our work instincts, and instead adopt the patience, the style of patience observed with Pardee Sabetti, required to get this ordering correct. Chapter 14. Missions Require Little Bets, in which I argue that great missions are transformed into great successes as the result of using small and achievable projects, little bets, to explore the concrete possibilities surrounding a compelling idea. Leaping the gap between idea and practice. My time with Pardee Sabetti convinced me that career capital is necessary to identify a good mission. But even as this understanding solidified, a nagging thought kept spoiling my intellectual satisfaction. Why don't I have a personal mission-driven career? When I met Pardee, I had a PhD in computer science from MIT, and close to 24 peer-reviewed publications to my name. I'd given talks on my work all over the world, from Rio to Bologna to Zurich. In other words, I had accumulated career capital, and this capital allowed me to identify many potential missions relevant to my skills. I even had a written record of these brainstorms, as I always keep an idea notebook with me. On March 13, 2011, for example, I recorded the possibility of focusing my career on a new style of distributed algorithm theory that was just emerging, the study of algorithms in communication graphs with unrestrained topology changes. I could, I noted, immerse myself in its development much in the same way the early proponents of chaos theory did in their field back in the early 1980s. But this brings me back to my nagging question. I had notebooks filled with potential missions, yet I had resisted devoting myself to any one in particular. And I'm not alone in this reluctance to act. Many people have lots of career capital and can therefore identify a variety of different potential missions for their work. But few actually build their career around such missions. It seems, therefore, that there's more to this career tactic than simply getting to the cutting edge. Once you have the capital required to identify a mission, you must still figure out how to put the mission into practice. If you don't have a trusted strategy for making this leap from idea to execution, then, like me and so many others, you'll probably avoid the leap altogether. This chapter is the first of two that investigate people who have successfully made this leap. My goal for these investigations is to find specific strategies that take you from big idea to big results, the type of strategies that can transform the missions in my notebooks from being merely ideas to becoming the foundation of an attention-catching career. We'll start with the story of a brash young archaeologist from a small town in southeast Texas, someone who discovered a systematic strategy for deploying a bold mission in a field famous for its conformity. American Treasures. I first encountered Kirk French while watching the Discovery Channel. During a commercial break, I saw an ad for the network's newest show. It was called American Treasures. The spot showed a pair of young archaeologists, dressed in jeans and battered work shirts, driving around the American backcountry in an old Ford F-150, helping people determine the historical significance of their family heirlooms. The hosts, who were revealed to be archaeologists, Kirk French and Jason DeLeon, seemed loud and energetic and enjoying the hell out of what they were doing. It was like Antiques Roadshow, but with considerably more drinking and cursing. I set my DVR to record the premiere. Early in this first episode, Kirk and Jason find themselves in the East Texas flatlands at a run-down dirt road homestead. They are there to investigate the authenticity of a suit of clothes that supposedly belonged to Clyde Barrow of Bonnie and Clyde fame. It takes the archaeologists all of 30 seconds to disprove this claim. Not a lot of suits from that period feature a Made in China tag. But this doesn't dampen their enthusiasm. "You're from a moonshine family," notes French. "Yep," drawls Leslie, the suit's owner. "Let's try some moonshine." Soon a glass pitcher is produced. As Leslie pours the hooch into mason jars, he offers a warning. "Don't ask about the proof. You wouldn't drink it if you knew." As Kirk and Jason sit on a pair of logs, drinking the moonshine and swapping stories, surrounded by East Texas nothingness, they seem to be having a great time. I was hooked. To understand the appeal of American Treasures, you must understand its competition. At the time, cable TV was overrun with cash-for-junk-style shows, such as the History Channel's Pawn Stars, which follows the staff of a Las Vegas pawn shop as they try to bargain cash-strapped people out of valuable possessions, and the Discovery Channel's Auction Kings, which follows the adventures of an Atlanta-based auction house whose website deploys significantly more exclamation points than, say, Sotheby's might approve of. These shows, of course, are not to be confused with Discovery's American Pickers, which also follows a team that buys people's possessions, but now features the key twist that the bargain hunters travel in a van instead of working out of a storefront. And none of these should be confused with either Discovery's Auction Hunters or the History Channel's Storage Wars, both of which take a hard-hitting look at buying abandoned storage units at auction. A topic too nuanced, it seems, to be fully plumbed by only a single series. These programs never interested me, but something about American Treasures caught my attention. I think once I looked past the name, which Kirk later admitted to me he both hated and fought against, I was struck by the fact that the hosts had a purpose beyond just wanting to be on television. For one thing, they aren't full-time TV personalities, but are instead academic archaeologists. The Discovery Channel had to buy out a semester of their teaching obligations so they could film the first season. In addition, there's no exchanging of cash in this show, a mainstay of all other entries in this genre. Putting monetary value on artifacts is antithetical to the mission of archaeology, and Kirk and Jason refuse to do so in their show. The hosts, instead, seem driven by the idea that they're educating the public about the reality of modern archaeology. This is their mission, and as indicated by the smiles on their faces as they sipped East Texas moonshine in the premiere episode of their show, it's a mission that's a hell of a lot of fun to pursue. Not long after meeting Party Sabetti, around the time I started questioning why I didn't have a mission-driven career, Kirk and Jason popped back to mind. I realized that they provided a perfect case study of what it's like to leap a large gap between idea and practice. The mission of popularizing archaeology to a mass audience and having a fun time doing so sounds good on paper, but to actually devote your career to this mission, especially when you're just out of graduate school and trying to make a name for yourself in a traditional academic field, is a terrifying prospect. I called up Kirk to find out what strategy he used to make this leap with confidence. The Armchair Archaeologist. No one who knows him would describe Kirk French as boring. After Bush won the election in 2004, he told me, I sort of lost it. I sold everything and moved to the woods. The woods consisted of 16 acres of old farmland, and it was a 20-minute drive from the Penn State campus where Kirk was a graduate student at the time. While living in his hermit mode, he decided to build a wooden stage in an apple tree grove not far from his cabin and organize a music festival, which he called, naturally, Kirkfest. Jason DeLeon, a fellow grad student at Penn State, had a band named Wilcox Hotel at the time, which played at the festival. He admired Kirk's entrepreneurial streak and asked if he wanted to manage Wilcox Hotel. Kirk thought it sounded like fun. They ended up taking time off from their graduate studies to buy a minibus and drive across the country and back on tour. They also recorded 2 CDs during this period. I tell these stories because they emphasize that Kirk is someone who is not afraid to try something bold if it holds out the promise of making his life more interesting. During this period as a graduate student, Kirk, who specialized in Mayan water management, was interviewed for a History Channel documentary on the Maya called Lost Worlds. As someone always seeking creative outlets for his energy, this experience helped Kirk cement a potential mission for his career, to popularize modern archaeology to a mass audience. His first efforts to explore this direction began after he graduated with his Ph.D. and became a postdoc, and they centered on a classic 1961 documentary called Land and Water, an ecological study of the Teotihuacan Valley of Mexico, filmed by the late Penn State archaeologist William Sanders. This film documents how the rise of Mexico City has transformed the ecology and lifestyle in the Teotihuacan Valley. For those, like Kirk, who study historical ecology, it's an influential film. In the fall of 2009, Kirk got his hands on the original 16mm reels, including outtakes that never made the original cut, as well as Sanders' notes. He launched 2 projects surrounding this find. The first was to digitize the original film footage and release a DVD of the original documentary, a project he completed in the spring of 2010. The second project was more ambitious. He decided to film a new version of the documentary, an update that would show the further changes that have happened between the 1960s and the present in the valley. Kirk raised seed money from Penn State's Anthropology Department and the Maya Exploration Center, put together a team, and in the winter of 2010 headed down to Mexico City to begin filming sample footage. The goal was to pull together enough compelling shots to convince funding agencies of the importance of the project. Kirk's breakthrough for his mission, however, began in December 2009. George Milner, a professor in the office next to Kirk, called him in to join a group of archaeologists who were all standing around Milner's phone. "You've got to listen to this message," he said while dialing into his voicemail. The recording was of a man who lived just north of Pittsburgh. He sounded articulate and thoughtful, at least until he got to the reason he was calling the Penn State Archaeology Department. "I've got what I think is the treasure of the Knights Templar in my backyard," he explained. The gathered academics all had a good laugh, but then Kirk interjected, "I'm going to call him back." His more experienced colleagues tried to talk him out of it. "He will never leave you alone," they told him. "He will call you back every week and keep asking you questions." As Kirk explained to me, in an academic field like archaeology, you get a lot of these types of calls. People who think they found a dinosaur footprint or whatever, and there's just not time with the pressure of research and teaching to keep up with them. But Kirk saw an opportunity here that would support his mission. "This type of public outreach is exactly what we archaeologists should be doing," he realized. He decided he was going to follow up on the random calls that came into the department. He planned to go meet the people, hear their stories, and help explain how the principles of archaeology can lead them to figure out whether or not a medieval organization of knights was actually traipsing around the hills of Pittsburgh. Not only would he meet them, but he would also film the encounters, with the eventual goal of producing a documentary on the most interesting case. He called the project the Armchair Archaeologist. He envisioned this side project taking 5 or 10 years, something to work on alongside his filming in the Teotihuacan Valley. I figured, at the very least, I could show it to the students in my intro archaeology classes, he said. On a Sunday morning, not long after hearing the call about the Knights Templar treasure, Kirk gathered a cameraman and soundman and headed out to Pittsburgh to investigate the claim. He was the coolest guy, Kirk recalls. He had crazy ideas, but he was fun to talk to. We hung out all day and had some beers and chatted. The treasure, it turns out, was just some old deer bones and railroad spikes found in a gravel pit. But the experience was invigorating for Kirk. It also turned out to be more consequential than he could ever have guessed. Around this time, the Discovery Channel decided it wanted a reality show that had something to do with archaeology. As is common in the TV business, instead of developing the idea themselves, the channel instead spread word of their general interest and left it to the independent production companies to pull together specific show concepts. 3 months after Kirk filmed his Pittsburgh footage, one of these production companies contacted the head of the archaeology department at Penn State, who forwarded the message to the whole staff. "Sure, I only had 3 months of experience on my job as a lecturer at the time," Kirk recalled. "But I was really interested in media, so I thought, why not me?" Kirk followed up with the production company. "I have your show idea," he told them, not long into their initial conversation. He sent them his Armchair Archaeologist footage. The production company loved the idea, and they loved Kirk. They refilmed his visit to the Templars' treasure site and sent the tape to the Discovery Channel and the History Channel. The latter agreed to finance a pilot, but the former said, "Screw a pilot, let's film 8 episodes. When they asked Kirk about a co-host, he had only one name to offer, his good friend, Jason DeLeon, who had also recently graduated Penn State and had just started as an assistant professor at Michigan. They both arranged for the Discovery Channel to buy out their teaching obligations for the following fall, and then hit the road to film the first season of what would become American Treasures. Leveraging Little Bets. Kirk's mission was to popularize archaeology, and he wanted to do so in a way that generated an exciting life. Hosting American Treasures made this mission a reality. The question at hand is how he made this leap from a general idea into specific action. Here's what I noticed. Kirk's path to American Treasures was incremental. He didn't decide out of nowhere that he wanted to host a television show and then work backward to make that dream a reality. Instead, he worked forward from his original mission to popularize archaeology with a series of small, almost tentative steps. When he stumbled on the old film reels for Land and Water, for example, he decided to digitize them and produce a DVD. After this small step, he took the slightly larger step of raising money to shoot exploratory footage for a new version of the documentary. When George Milner played him that fateful answering machine tape, Kirk took another modest step by launching the Armchair Archaeologist project, with no real vision of how it would prove useful, other than perhaps as fodder for his intro archaeology courses. This final little step, however, turned out to be a winner, leading directly to his own television show. As I was struggling to make sense of Kirk's story, I stumbled across a new business book that had been making waves. It was titled Little Bets, and it was written by a former venture capitalist named Peter Sims. When Sims studied a variety of successful innovators, from Steve Jobs to Chris Rock to Frank Gehry, as well as innovative companies such as Amazon and Pixar, he found a strategy common to all. Rather than believing they have to start with a big idea or plan out a whole project in advance, he writes, they make a methodical series of little bets about what might be a good direction, learning critical information from lots of little failures and from small but significant wins. This rapid and frequent feedback, Sims argues, allows them to find unexpected avenues and arrive at extraordinary outcomes. To illustrate this idea, Sims details the example of Chris Rock preparing a comedy set for one of his acclaimed HBO specials. Rock, it turns out, will make somewhere between 40 to 50 unannounced visits to a small New Jersey area comedy club to help him figure out which material works and which doesn't. As Sim notes, he shows up on stage with a yellow legal pad, working through different jokes, taking notes on the crowd's reaction. Most of the material falls flat. It's not uncommon for Rock to look up and say, "This needs to be fleshed out more," while the crowd laughs at the awkwardness of Rock's flops.